light, eager to know what humiliations and depredations Thanos had in store for them. Bane. First appearance, January 1993. Batman, Vengeance of Bane, number 1. Anyone who is raised in a high-security prison, isolated on an island in South America, and injected with a super-steroidal chemical, probably isn't going to grow up to work for the Peace Corps. Bane was yet another of the highly imaginative and engaging villains to populate the Batman's rogues gallery. While stuck in the prison of Santa Prisca, courtesy of editor Denny O'Neill, Bane was hooked up to a pump that allowed him to ingest a toxic chemical called Venom. While he developed the furthest reaches of his own intelligence, his body began a relentless mutation. Deducing Batman's identity, he escaped to Gotham City, where he released the worst miscreants of Arkham Asylum into the streets. Eventually trapping Batman in the Batcave, Bane used his brute strength to snap Batman's back. This led to the storyline of Nightfall, in which the recovering Batman is superseded by a far more violent acolyte named Azrael. While loyal comics readers knew of Bane's terribly violent nature and ruthless intelligence, viewers of the misguided 1997 film Batman and Robin only saw Bane as a hulking, monosyllabic pro wrestler. When Christopher Nolan took over the cinematic reins of the character with The Dark Knight Rises in 2012, he restored Bane to the height of his homicidal dignity and gave Batman, Gotham City, and audiences around the world a terrible force with which to be reckoned. Wahoo! CGI meets the superhero. According to writer Chris Claremont, to me, the whole point of comics is a writer can sit down with a penciler and in 22 pages create a visual presentation that would cost Jim Cameron 15 years and $1 billion to figure out. Claremont is correct about how much easier it is to create a comic book than a film. Director James Cameron never made the Spider-Man film he announced in 1990. In the end, it took 12 more years and $139 million to bring the wall crawler to the screen, thanks to a little magic genie called CGI. Marvel Comics had nothing but travails in bringing their characters to the screen, and it was heartbreaking for them not to have a tentpole Spider-Man movie, while DC Warner were cleaning up with their characters. "They didn't have the special effects that they have now," said Stan Lee. "There was no way of doing it. Today, when you see Spider-Man swinging on that web from building to building, it's fantastic. Couldn't do that 20 years ago. But it's like any movie, based on any books or anything. You have to have people who understand the story and are able to tell it in the most interesting, believable way." Sony Pictures found a way to make the Spider-Man story believable, hiring director Sam Raimi, actor Tobey Maguire as a sensitive but spunky Peter Parker, and bringing it all together in a 2002 movie that could finally render both the vertigo-inducing, skyscraping, swinging world of Spider-Man and the personal trials and tribulations that toiled underneath. It didn't hurt that Spider-Man was just the hero that America needed in the aftermath of 9/11. In fact, a summer trailer for the film in 2001 showed a helicopter full of bank robbers being stuck between the Twin Towers, courtesy of an immense spider web. It was quickly dropped from theaters, and the towers themselves were digitally blurred from the background of actual location shots in the eventual release. Spider-Man respected the origins and background of the action hero, conveying both his derring do and his sense of humor. When Peter Parker, exercising his newfound abilities for the first time, attempts to shoot a web across a rooftop, he rehearses several battle cries, hoping to find one that fits. "Up, up and away!" "Shazam!" and "Flame on!" thereby endearing himself to every comic book fan in the audience. Eventually, "Wahoo!" seems to do the trick. It was that rare film that satisfied both the immense fan base while bringing in audiences that would not traditionally be lured into a summer action blockbuster featuring a guy in tights. In its initial release, Spider-Man earned more than 6 times its production costs and eventually spun 2 sequels and a reboot. An upside-down kiss in the rain between the mysteriously masked Spider-Man and red-headed actress Mary Jane Watson encapsulated the movie's transcendent appeal. All of us who worked in comics were thought of as the types who lived in the basement with our mom, said Jeff Loeb. Then suddenly Spider-Man came out, and girls were going, moms were going, families were going, people were suddenly going, whoa, hang on a second, this is sexy. Comics suddenly became sexy. Aided by the critical and commercial success of the first 2 X-Men movies, which came out at roughly the same time, Spider-Man ushered in a string of cinematic blockbusters for the Marvel line. They had a dedicated film company, Marvel Productions, which teamed up with various studios and, under the guidance of producer-executive president Kevin Feige, brought some highly unlikely characters to the screen, such as Iron Man, a not-quite-household-name superhero whose first 2 solo adventures nonetheless brought in more than $1.2 billion at the box office. Feige, an acknowledged comic book nerd, had a particular gift for keeping fans happy while bringing in the first weekend crowds. I'm not sure there is a formula or a secret, he said, but I do know that problems tend to happen when people try and reinvent the wheel. If you actually open the comics, there is a lot of depth there. Despite the occasional misfire, such as Daredevil and 2 Hulk movies, something about old Greenskin allows him to smash everything except box office records, Feige's more than 2 dozen Marvel film projects have brought in more than $7 billion in admission tickets across the globe. Perhaps some of the extraordinary appeal of these movies can be derived from the anxieties of the post-9/11 new normal. Writer Grant Morrison thinks so. Suddenly superheroes became real things that weren't completely ridiculous, and they were suddenly being explained to us in terms of how Iron Man would actually work. In the first film, there's an evenly paced half hour of Robert Downey Jr. banging together a suit of armor so that it's convincing to the audience. The next great superhero movie phenomenon also involved a billionaire working secretly on armored paraphernalia in a high-tech hideaway in order to bring justice to a world that desperately needed it. When Warner Brothers decided to tackle Batman again in 2004, this time with visionary director and writer Christopher Nolan, they were, in many ways, up against the same problems they had faced 16 years earlier when trying to create a serious Batman movie in the wake of the television series. The previous Batman film outing, Batman and Robin, from 1997, had been excoriated for its over-the-top theatrics and its disco diva designs, especially the batsuits with faux nipples. So, with Batman Begins, the heat was on Nolan to create a serious Batman who had some resonance for 21st century audiences. Inspired by the 1978 Superman movie, Nolan went back to Batman's roots to explore something that, strangely enough, no Batman movie had ever done. What I wanted to do, explained Nolan, was to tell the Batman story I'd never seen, the one that the fans had been wanting to see, the story of how Bruce Wayne becomes Batman. There were also a lot of very interesting gaps in the mythology that we were able to interpret ourselves and bring in our own ideas of how Bruce Wayne and Batman would have evolved specifically. Once again, the success of a superhero movie would depend on a balance between the director's respect for the material and the casting of the lead role. Nolan had a Bruce Wayne no one could kvetch about. The raven-haired, taciturn Christian Bale, who lost his voice 3 times during shooting, trying to find the pitch of the Batman's subterranean growl. The Dark Knight in Batman Begins, from 2005, was the perfect spin on the hero for his times. Neither campy nor psychologically unstable, he was cruel only to be kind. In a climactic battle with his adversary, Ra's al Ghul asks him, "Have you finally learned to do what is necessary?" Batman responds, "I won't kill you, but I don't have to save you." The success of Batman Begins, a unique and chancy reboot of a franchise, the first of its kind, surprised everyone by doubling its original investment at the box office and setting off two highly regarded sequels, also directed by Nolan, The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises. Taken together, the trilogy has earned $2.5 billion, making it the most successful superhero franchise of its time. But the Dark Knight films have more to offer than box office coin. Heath Ledger became the first actor ever to win an Academy Award for a superhero film for his twisted, original take on the Joker in The Dark Knight. The films also offered a prism through which audiences could view unconventional heroism in the tense times of the early 21st century. Batman's costume was composed of elements more befitting a commando or a black ops agent than a traditional superhero, and the Gotham City under his vigilante purview was a fearsome, unstable place where enemies could spring out of nowhere and deliver devastating, unpredictable chaos. In a Rolling Stone essay that profiled the 2012 The Dark Knight Rises, novelist Jonathan Latham found the Christopher Nolan Christian Bale team a metaphor for the time. In any era, we get the Batman we deserve. It is our belief in his great purpose that sustains him. Batman's refusal to wield a gun, the weapon that killed his parents, links him to a classic American problem, being, is the man violent enough to clear the path for civilization, himself unfit to participate in civilized society? He's the manned drone of 21st century urban warfare. For all the dark implications of the trilogy, the three Batman movies were dark in nearly every respect, the series ended on a hopeful note, suggesting that, after nearly 75 years in the superhero business, Batman was inspiring enough to inflame a heroic streak in anyone's heart. Nolan's Batman was just another iteration of the most elastic crusader in comic book history. Yes, including Plastic Man, a paladin of retribution who could inhabit whatever eccentricities and fears the culture could dish out. Just an everyman in a black mask and cape who devoted his existence to the enervating but revitalizing quest for justice. As he says towards the end of The Dark Knight Rises, a hero can be anyone. Even a man doing something as simple and reassuring as putting a coat around a little boy's shoulders to let him know that the world hadn't ended. The Avengers. And there came a day unlike any other, when Earth's mightiest heroes and heroines found themselves united against a common threat. On that day, the Avengers were born, to fight the foes no single superhero could withstand. The Avengers have always had their headquarters in the most exclusive neighborhoods, a mansion on Fifth Avenue, and a state-of-the-art 93-story high-rise skyscraper. And that's probably a good thing, considering how much damage that they have dealt out and dealt with in their 50-year history. You probably wouldn't want them living on your block. When Stan Lee and Jack Kirby brought the Avengers forth on the world in the summer of 1963, they were largely borrowing from the format successfully reintroduced at DC with the Justice League of America. Put all your superstars into one package. Indeed, they brought together Marvel's major unaffiliated heavy hitters, Iron Man, Thor, the Hulk, and Ant-Man and his paramour, the Wasp. The latter two were never exactly heavy hitters in the Marvel lineup, but they were loyal. Ant-Man was also an ingenious scientist, Hank Pym, which came in handy. Why Spider-Man was never introduced into the team way back when is a bit of a mystery. He was a major draw, after all, but perhaps Lee wisely thought Spidey was not a joiner. The Avengers turned into a title that was larger than the sum of its parts when Captain America reappeared in number 4, and further when he took over the reins as the team's inevitable leader. By issue number 16, Cap was required to become company recruiter as well, when Stan Lee, mindful of the fact that Iron Man and Thor had obligations elsewhere in their own titles, cycled out his original team. The new Avengers team, still led by Captain America, was now constituted of the Scarlet Witch and her brother, the moody Quicksilver, two reformed members of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, and Hawkeye, a smart-ass archer with a purple costume who was also once a villain in the Marvel Universe. The fact that the new recruits were Avengers first and foremost, without solo books of their own, somehow made the group more appealing and powerful. By the end of the 1960s, the Avengers had gained the Black Panther, and under the guidance of editor-writer Roy Thomas, a brand new character called the Vision, a synthesized android who took some of his body parts from the original Human Torch and much of his emotionless, logical mien from Mr. Spock of TV Star Trek. His devotion to the team, however, made him one of the most beloved and reliable Avengers for the next four decades. Throughout the 1970s, the Avengers evolved into something more exciting than a contrived team-up book. Thrust by Thomas into more interplanetary sagas, such as the nine-part Kree-Skrull War epic, the team became the go-to group in the Marvel Universe for big-canvas, colorful epics. David Lean would have been a good director for their Panavision-sized exploits. The Avengers also contained an extra helping of Marvel-styled soap opera. Hank Pym suffers an inferiority complex, becomes a schizophrenic, and physically abuses his now wife, the Wasp. The synthetic Vision compiles enough emotive particles to fall in love with, then propose marriage to, the Scarlet Witch, who readily accepts. The Vision-Scarlet Witch relationship would become even more complex as the years went on. He would lead a misguided attempt to take over the world's computers, and in the aftermath, be dismantled, before being restored again, of course. The Scarlet Witch would raise two children from her union with the Vision, only to discover they were only figments of her imagination, which drove her mad and caused her to wreak havoc on her teammates. It's an Avengers world, folks. Longtime Avengers editor Tom Brevoort wrote that the Avengers' appeal comes about largely because of the volunteerism of their membership. They are not a family, not a persecuted minority, not grouped together by geography or gathered by the government. The Avengers are the Avengers because they want to be, because they need to be, in order to safeguard the world. Captain America, Iron Man, Thor, usually the Vision, and some iteration of Ant-Man and the Wasp were cornerstone members of the team throughout the end of the 20th century. But the group could also be a catch-all for some of the more idiosyncratic outliers in the Marvel Universe, such as Tigra, occasionally known as Tigra the Werewoman, the She-Hulk, a far more articulate and attractive cousin of the Hulk, the Black Knight, a pseudo-medieval character whose Marvel Comics roots stretched back to the 1950s, and Mantis, a former Vietnamese bar girl who is destined to give birth to the Celestial Messiah. These engaging oddballs were but a few of the dozens of Avengers members over the years. Despite such compelling characters and storylines, The Avengers was not a particularly best-selling comic. Editors at Marvel Comics pondered the dilemma, and according to editor-in-chief Joe Quesada, it was Scottish-born writer Mark Miller who gave him the key to the puzzle.
And it was Mark Miller who cited going to a candy store as a kid and looking for comics, and he was a DC fan at the time as a little kid, and he saw a Superman title, he saw a Wonder Woman title, he saw a Batman title, and then all of a sudden he saw a Justice League title. And as he puts it, being Scottish, he felt that was the better place to spend his money because he could get all three in one book as opposed to buying three separate titles. And he brought up the idea, why, if these are supposed to be Earth's mightiest heroes, why aren't Marvel's biggest characters in the book? And he was right, because as you look at Avengers, it became about Jack of Hearts and Triathlon and all these sort of C and D level characters, And every once in a while, you'd sprinkle in a Captain America and a Thor and an Iron Man. But why wasn't Spider-Man in the Avengers? Why wasn't Wolverine in the Avengers? These are the characters that are prime movers in our licensing programs, in our movie slate, but yet they were nowhere near the title that we wanted to be our number one title. So we worked out a methodology by which these characters can play all in the same sandbox. And guess what? It becomes our number one title.
Under the skillful pen of writer Brian Michael Bendis, the Avengers would disassemble in 2004 due to an apocalyptic meltdown by the Scarlet Witch and regroup under a variety of successful franchises. At one point in the 1980s, a West Coast Avengers was constituted, as well as a Great Lakes Avengers, but the less said about them, the better, and had a decent run, but these new groups required a scorecard that would tax even the Vision's exceptional organization capacity. There were the New Avengers, which indeed included Spider-Man and Wolverine, and were led by the same Luke Cage, hero for hire, from the 1970s. There were the inevitable Young Avengers, junior varsity versions of our heroes. The Mighty Avengers, a government-sponsored subgroup commandeered by Iron Man in the wake of the Civil War series. Dark Avengers, a disguised group of villains. Ultimate Avengers, an alternative reality where S.H.I.E.L.D. leader Nick Fury was now an African-American. Secret Avengers, a Black Ops version. And Avengers Academy, which recruited and trained up-and-coming Avengers, although the likelihood of Marvel running out of potential members seems highly unlikely. Of course, the big news about the Avengers was their 2012 film debut, the result of a careful cultivation of the fan-based audience and a related slate of films that preceded it, each introducing the major characters of the Hulk, Iron Man, Thor, and Captain America. As of 2013, Marvel's The Avengers is the third most successful movie of any kind or genre in Hollywood history. Director Joss Whedon painstakingly tapped into the dynamics of the team. He was strongly influenced by the early 1960s Avengers comics, of which he was a fan while growing up. As he said, "In those comics, these people shouldn't be in the same room, let alone on the same team, and that is the definition of family." Whedon is on board to write and direct the highly anticipated sequel, which is due to hit movie theaters in May 2015. It may be churlish to report that a film version of the Justice League of America, the DC team that inspired the Avengers in the first place, has been stuck in development hell since 2007 with no apparent specific forward movement. So it looks like the Avengers have a long lead on the worldwide media domination front. But, heck, what's a little friendly rivalry between super teams? The pulse-pounding conclusion. And so, our hero... "We won," claims Marv Wolfman. He wasn't talking about a triumph by the Justice League over the Anti-Monitor, or about the Avengers beating back yet another conquest by the Skrull Empire. He was talking about comic book fans. All of us who have been told that what we did was for kids, or what we enjoyed was silly, or that we were geeks or dorks or whatever else. Well, it turns out the whole world actually is, but it took them a while to admit it. We won because our type of fantasy is now everywhere, which means if you like superheroes, you can find it in the movies. You can find it on TV. You can find it in animation. We took our comic book readership and spread it over 5 other media. It's hard to argue with a wandering wolfman. Superheroes are everywhere. A contributing factor to the media conquest by superheroes was 2 separate but equally powerful industry events in 2009. The formation of DC Entertainment within Warner Brothers and the acquisition of Marvel Entertainment by the Walt Disney Company. While DC's considerable assets were being consolidated and cross-pollinated in Burbank, over in Anaheim, Disney, which paid $4 billion for Marvel's intellectual property, found itself at a slight disadvantage, as many of the high-profile characters, Spider-Man, the X-Men, had already been optioned by several different studios. Still, the deal gave Disney a library of literally hundreds of unique and colorful characters with the potential for long-lasting franchises. And, as Stan Lee put it, nobody knows how to play in that ballpark better than Disney. The broad shoulders of a corporate entity allow for material to be tailored for a vastly diverse audience. There is no longer a one-size-fits-all superhero. The evolution of sophisticated video games has provided a useful example. Products pitched to incipient young gamers, Lego Batman and Lego Batman 2, featuring innocent situations and simple graphics from the durable plastic block toys, have sold millions of units. In the meantime, an infinitely more mature and unsettling set of action-adventure video games based on the Arkham Asylum comic book series, Batman Arkham Asylum and its sequel Batman Arkham City, has sold more than 10 million units since 2009. Parents had better not mix up Lego Batman with Batman Arkham around the PlayStation unless they want to front a hefty therapy bill for their child. The video game, along with the embryonic digital distribution of comics, offers brand new delivery systems for consumers of all ages, even if all the adventures of their favorite superhero can be shrunk into an app that fits snugly on your smartphone. Ant-Man himself couldn't have invented a more ingenious way to enjoy comics. Amazing to think that when comic books first emerged in the depths of the Depression, they were the most disposable of consumer commodities. Dog-eared pulps at 10 cents a pop. In 2012, sales of comic books reached more than $318 million. The addition of trade paperbacks, graphic novels, and reprints brought the total of comic book narratives to $475 million, representing an increase of 15% from the previous year. A fair amount of the surge can be attributed to the interest in DC's new 52 titles, which were introduced throughout 2011 and 2012. It also helped DC achieve near parity in the market share to Marvel. They each have about 37% of the market, the closest that DC has come to taking the lead in years. 50 separate titles sold more than 100,000 copies, and 5 sold more than 200,000. But a paradox remains. Nearly all of those titles were either landmark issues. Images, The Walking Dead number 100, sold a spectacular 353,000 copies, or part of some heavily promoted summer blockbuster series, such as Avengers vs. X-Men. Monthly readership of cornerstone titles, Fantastic Four or Action Comics, rarely top more than 120,000 copies, a far cry from the heyday of comic book sales. At the movies, however, in a domain that has rendered comic book superheroes satisfactorily for only about two decades, the financial results are astronomical. In 2012 alone, superhero movies earned $3.5 billion internationally, and there's no end in sight. The standard bearer of that summer was The Avengers, released by Marvel Studios and Paramount Pictures. Within 6 months, it earned $1.5 billion worldwide, and the climax also featured the largest number of major superheroes ever assembled on a movie screen. In real life, comic book conventions had been assembling superheroes by the hundreds ever since the 1970s. Now, the phenomenon has reached unavoidable proportions. The San Diego International Comic-Con, held every July, has become the beacon of the entertainment world. Hollywood studios use the convention to offer sneak previews of their most valued products with major Hollywood stars in tow, eager to spend an afternoon in a stifling windowless room crowded with enthusiastic fans who are often dressed in homemade and elaborate costumes based on their favorite hero or heroine. The typically three-day affairs are chock-full of events catering to every demographic and interest. There are the obligatory costume parade competitions, panel discussions that cover manifold topics, from the legal ramifications of comic books to how to break into the industry, the children's market, and the unveiling of upcoming storylines, films, and documentaries. celebrity and pseudo-celebrity autograph signings, artist alleys, where leading artists will draw you an original sketch for a fee, and, at the center of it all, a vast bazaar of goods, where purveyors of fantasy push toys, collectibles, costumes, video games, weaponry, and, oh yes, comic books. The San Diego convention attracts more than 130,000 people, as does a rival convention every fall in New York City, and would host even more if the fire code regulations would permit. Nevertheless, the convention earns national television coverage, daily reports from the front in the New York Times, and the cover of Entertainment Weekly. 5 decades after they were nearly driven into the ground by a Senate subcommittee, comic books have shaken off the carapace of shame that dogged them for decades. The Comics Code Authority is defunct. Marvel Comics instituted its own rating system in 2001. DC Comics stopped submitting their books in 2010. Even that avatar of respectability, Archie Comics, bypassed the code authorities in 2012, rendering the imposition of regulations essentially irrelevant. In 2013, a researcher from the University of Illinois seems to have driven the final stake in the heart of Dr. Frederick Wortham. Examining his research methods, she concluded that he may well have, quote, manipulated, overstated, compromised, and fabricated evidence. Called comfort to those whose careers foundered on the shoals of Wortham's campaign, but this new research into his methodology implies that his agenda drove his conclusions rather than the other way around. If a Senate subcommittee tarnished comic books in the mid-1950s, the executive branch gave the medium the ultimate shout-out in 2008. Real-life presidents had appeared in comics since Franklin D. Roosevelt made a cameo in the first issue of Captain America as a sponsor of the Super Soldier Project, but there had never been a president who was an outspoken fan of comic books until candidate Barack Obama stepped forward in an Entertainment Weekly interview in 2008. When asked about comic books, apparently he was a collector as a kid, Obama opined, "I was always into the Spider-Man-Batman model. The guys who have too many powers, like Superman, that always made me think they weren't really earning their superhero status. It's a little too easy. Whereas Spider-Man and Batman, they have some inner turmoil. They get knocked around a little bit." Comic book fans around the country went berserk with the happiness of conferred recognition. Marvel Comics, seeing an opportunity, elbowed DC out of the receiving line. According to Joe Quesada, "Obama put our name in the press and put our character's name in the press. We figured we needed to tip our hat back. It seemed to us that he was a Spider-Man kind of guy, so we put him on a special Inauguration Day cover." The Amazing Spider-Man, number 583, featured a short introductory story that had Peter Parker covering the inauguration of Obama in Washington and foiling a nefarious plot by the master of disguise, the Chameleon, who attempted to trade places with Obama. The inauguration issue went into 5 separate printings, with variant covers, and sold more than 350,000 copies, roughly 5 times what a typical Spider-Man comic sold at the time. Weeks later, Newsarama.com correspondent Michael Duran questioned the potential effect of Obama's stimulus package, but, quote, "The new president has already stimulated sales in at least one American industry." If comic books were popular with the President of the United States, comic book characters always enjoy near universal popularity with average citizens around the world, and perhaps this has led the way for them, finally, to be accorded respect. In an interview months before he passed away, comic book legend Joe Kubert reflected, "Comic books had always been looked at as a junk medium, as stuff for kids. An adult would have been ashamed to be caught reading a comic book. That's quite different today. The utilization of superheroes in movies and in other venues has put the mantle of acceptance on the comic books that they have never had before." Frank Miller said that, quote, a generation of people who read comic books have come up and taken over certain aspects of entertainment. In other words, the inmates have taken over the asylum and you're all in trouble. Trouble or no, we have become, in the words of cultural historian Bradford Wright, a comic book nation. Superheroes have always come to the rescue when our nation was in its direst need. They arrived on the scene during the Depression, when our nation was plunged into fear and economic chaos, and they piloted us through our most overwhelming military conflict. They returned to dispel the anxiety over the threats from our greatest rivals, found in the atmosphere of outer space and in the mysteries at the heart of an atom. Superheroes shouldered the burden of living under the distress of a new, not-so-normal world, encroached by the shadows of terrorism and economic collapse. They always arrive just in the nick of time. We want to believe in superheroes, said Jeff Johns. And you know what? Superman will never let you down. Superheroes are a projection of American possibility, violence, justice, risk, and aspiration, said Adam West.
We want to be better. We want to be stronger. We want to be more heroic. It's a craving that we all have. And I recognize it. Having played a superhero, having played a pretend superhero, you know, I'm not a superhero. But I think I'm like any guy out there. You know, I'd like to watch people do heroic things.
Whether they burst forth from an IMAX movie screen, or leap out of our video screens and computer monitors, or get rolled up and thrust into the back pocket of an 11-year-old's dungarees, superheroes seem to have always been around, zooming through the sky, looking out for us on high. To quote another American hero, Abraham Lincoln, they are the better angels of our nature.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Superheroes, Capes, Cowls, and the Creation of Comic Book Culture by Lawrence Maslin, based on the documentary film by Michael Cantor. This program was directed by Scott Cresswell. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2013 by Lawrence Maslin and Michael Cantor. Selected interviews from the documentary film Superheroes, A Never-Ending Battle, copyright 2013, Ghostlight Films. Production copyright 2013, Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.